American Cassette Ministries takes great pride in presenting Dr. Agatha Thrash, one of America's foremost lecturers and authors on the subject of alternative preventative medicine. Prior to entering the field of preventative medicine, Dr. Agatha Thrash, a physician, practiced pathology for 15 years. Her husband, Calvin, also a physician, practiced internal medicine for 20 years. The doctors Thrash co-founded UT Pines Institute, a medical missionary training center in Seal, Alabama, and have authored various books, including Home Remedies, Nutrition for Vegetarians, Natural Remedies, The Animal Connection, and Eat for Strength, a vegetarian cookbook. Dr. Agatha Thrash has appeared on television and radio interviews and has lectured throughout the United States and Canada, as well as in Norway, Puerto Rico, Bermuda, and the Orient. And now, Dr. Agatha Thrash, in another excellent presentation designed to help you live a happier, healthier, and longer life.
Good evening. I'd like to talk with you about natural remedies today. Natural remedies are the specialty that my husband and I selected some time ago. We decided that the work that we had done for about 15 years with patients using traditional methods, in which we essentially put a cap on the symptoms of the patient without actually involving a healing process, was not as satisfying as it would be, we thought, to engage people in a lifestyle that would result in their being healed of their diseases. Now, to be healed of a disease means something altogether different from taking a drug that simply puts a cap on the symptoms. And so in order for us to understand more about this, we really needed to know a lot about physiology and anatomy. Physiology had always been our favorite subject in medical school and in all of the work that we had done. So it was not a great chore for us to enter into a program of the study of physiology. For the last 20 years, we have been studying physiology and anatomy and how it can be affected by things that we do to a person. Let's take such things as giving them a hot bath or altering the diet or directing an exercise program. All of these things can substantially alter the way that a person heals. When we became Seventh-day Adventists 20 years ago, this year is our anniversary year, we began to recognize right away that Seventh-day Adventists had understood a method of using the healing arts that was different from that of all other practitioners. We read one statement that went something like this: there are many ways of practicing the healing arts, but only one way that heaven approves. In regard to that, we understood that the ways of practicing the healing arts included such things as homeopathy and allopathy. Do you know what allopathy is? Anyone know what allopathy is? Well, most MDs don't know what allopathy is either, but that's the brand of medicine that MDs practice. Homeopathy means that similars heal. Allopathy means that dissimilars heal. So if you go to a homeopath, let's say you go for a cough. The homeopath will give you a small quantity of a medication that will increase coughing. If you go to an allopath or an MD, he will give you a large quantity of a substance that will paralyze your cough reflex. of the two of those, which would you rather have, the homeopathic remedy or the allopathic remedy? Yes, the homeopathic remedy would be the better one so far as a cough is concerned, isn't it? Homeopathic remedy would assist the body's own effort to throw off disease. Let us say you go to a physician with diarrhea. If you go to a homeopath, the homeopath will give you a small quantity of a substance that will increase your diarrhea. If you go to an allopath or an MD, he will give you a large quantity of a substance that will paralyze the bowel. Again, which remedy would you prefer? That of the homeopath or that of the allopath? The homeopath. And babies have died from being treated by a substance that will paralyze the bowel. If the bowel is paralyzed and the poisonous materials are bottled up inside of the individual, then these toxins can go throughout the body and can cause quite a great deal of problem. Babies have died from getting such substances as Lomotil for diarrhea. Now, we were told that it would be well for us to take the best of each branch of the healing arts and put this all together in one branch, and we would call that gospel medical missionary evangelism. We would not emphasize allopathy, we would not emphasize homeopathy, nor osteopathy, nor chiropractic, nor the eclectic, nor Ayurvedic, nor any other branch of the healing arts. We would merely take the best. In the two cases that I have mentioned to you in the treatment of homeopathy or allopathy, we would certainly want to do what we could to take the homeopathic remedies for that type of illness. It is this thing of encouraging the body or working with the body's own internal mechanisms for the treatment of disease that I would like to present to you tonight. Seventh-day Adventists have also taught that so far as our living in this age is concerned, that it would be well if we learned how to practice using the natural remedies. And so Adventists have read such statements as this: I wish to tell you, brethren, that soon there will be no work done along missionary lines except the medical missionary work. No work done along missionary lines. That means that all kinds of work done by God's people will be cut off. The Bible very clearly tells that there will be a time of trouble in our age, a time of trouble such as there never was since there was a nation. During that time, we can expect that all kinds of missionary work will be cut off except that of the medical missionary work. And even for that, there will be no buying or selling of services. If you are sick, you will not be able to buy services. If you are a physician or a nurse or a person trained in hydrotherapy and natural remedies, you will not be able to sell your services. While there is yet time, you should make yourselves knowledgeable about the course and cause of illness and its treatment. And that is a part of what we will be doing tonight. Now, I believe you have distributed to you already a little booklet called Health Emphasis Seminar. If you will take this syllabus, turn to the last page, please. The last page is entitled The Great Final Test. The Great Final Test is a test that will come to God's people in the end of time. Since only the medical missionary work will be available to God's people, they cannot buy or sell. But it might be that they would be supported by the recipients of their services. They might be able to get, as Elijah did, their bread and water. Then it would be an important thing for us to understand what the great final test is. From Unabridged Loma Linda Messages, page 602, we read this: "The truth for this time, the third angel's message, is to be proclaimed with a loud voice, meaning with increased power, as we approach the great final test. This test must come to the churches in connection with true medical missionary work, a work that has the great physician to dictate and preside in all it comprehends." Now, if you are as I was when I first read this statement, you will not know what a true medical missionary is. You will think, perhaps, of that medical person that you know the most. Well, that person that I knew best was myself. When I read this statement where it said medical missionary work, I thought of the kind of training that I had had. But after I read the whole of Loma Linda Messages, I began to recognize that the kind of training that I had had as a physician was not entirely what was being talked about. Pathology, anatomy, physiology, histology, biochemistry, all of this kind of thing was certainly intended in this thing of the true medical missionary. And the true medical missionary will not come behind on any of the basic sciences. He will not come behind on any of the remedies. He will understand all of these as they apply to physiology and anatomy. But still, I felt that I did not understand what the true medical missionary was. Then I read in Review and Herald articles for March 6, 1913, this statement that you see written here: "The true medical missionary." Immediately, my attention perked up, and I thought, here will perhaps be a definition. So I read this with great interest: "The true medical missionary will be wise in the treatment of the sick, using the remedies that nature provides." We generally call that the natural remedies. "And then he will look to Christ as the true healer of diseases. The principles of health reform brought into the life of the patient, the use of nature's remedies, and the cooperation of divine agencies in behalf of the suffering will bring success." Threefold definition. Number one is the principles of health reform brought into the life of the patient. Second, the use of nature's remedies. And third, the cooperation of divine agencies in behalf of the suffering. And then we're given this promise, and that is that these will bring success. Now let's take these one by one. I'd like to make a comment on them. Let's take the principles of health reform. These are such things as proper diet, regularity in all that we do, having a happy, cheerful outlook on life. All of these are things that have to do with the maintenance of good health. The proper clothing of the body, proper posture, all of these things, cleanliness, pleasant surroundings, pleasant, clean, and sunshiny surroundings. All of these have to do with the principles of health reform. These should be applied to a person every day. But now let's take the second part of this threefold definition, and that is the use of nature's remedies. The natural remedies would include such things as air, sunshine, water, a proper diet, rest, abstemiousness, that is the control of one's pleasures, exercise, and trust in divine power. Now, is trust in divine power an actual remedy for disease? And the answer is yes. Trust in divine power will help a person not to be sick. It will also assist you to live longer. It is a fact that religious people actually live longer than do irreligious people. It is a fact also that when people are operated on, if they are religious, they are more likely to recuperate without sequelae from the operation than is the person who is not religious. A woman giving birth is more likely to recover without complication, if she is religious than if she is not religious. And a person having an accident or an illness is also capable of recovering better. If you take 1,000 people, than are those individuals, they will not recover so fast if they are not religious. So trust in divine power is an actual remedy for disease. And I'll have a bit more to say about that in a little bit when I tell you about endorphins and enkephalins and how faith in the remedy can help a person to turn on his internal mechanisms of healing. And that's an important part of what I want to talk with you about tonight. So if we take all of these things, the cooperation of divine agencies in behalf of the suffering, that means an actual involvement in the sickness of the individual by the Holy Spirit and holy angels. I wish we had time to go into the subject tonight of how the Holy Spirit is involved in all healing in the human body. The movement of every white blood cell, even the healing of trees when a limb falls off, all of that healing, all healing is under the power of the Holy Spirit in the earth. And as we deal with healing, we are actually cooperating with the influence of the Holy Spirit in the life of the individual. It is a very precious privilege that we have of understanding the relationship between the cooperation of divine and human agencies in the healing of the sick. This same kind of cooperation is the kind of cooperation that we have when we plant a garden. We cannot make the germination of a seed. We cannot make the sunshine, nor can we make carbon dioxide. All of these things are provided by God, but the human agent plants the seed, cultivates it, maybe even waters it if the rain doesn't, and then expects the harvest. Divine agencies, human agencies, both working together to produce a garden. The same kind of thing occurs when we cooperate with divine agencies in behalf of the suffering. The most exciting discovery that has occurred in this century, to my mind, and I'm sure you will indulge me in that, has to do with the endorphin and enkephalin system. You've doubtless heard of these. They've been written about a good bit in newspapers, news magazines, and health magazines during the last 10 years since their discovery. When they were first discovered, they were spoken of as natural morphine. Do you remember that? About 10 years ago when it was publicized widely. Everybody was excited about this natural morphine which had been discovered. Endorphins and enkephalins were not discovered accidentally, as are many discoveries in anatomy and physiology. Endorphins and enkephalins were suspected of being present because of the action of naloxone on the central nervous system. And so the researchers went looking for it. They found the exact substance that they had expected to find, and it is a form of natural morphine, or we could look at it in that way. But there is an interesting thing about endorphins and enkephalins, and that is this. If a person has a strong faith, it assists the person in the turning on of his endorphins and enkephalins. Endorphins and enkephalins in turn turn on our internal mechanisms of healing. Now this faith can be faith in anything. It can be faith in the physician. It can be faith in the medicine or in the remedy or the counseling or whatever. Faith in anything will assist you in producing the endorphins and enkephalins. We believe that faith in God is the only proper faith, and that it is the most powerful faith for the sick person to have. So if the sick person has faith in God, this assists him to cooperate with divine agencies to bring about his own healing. If he has a faith in God, this somehow assists him to mobilize his own resources, his own internal resources. And I'd like to give you an illustration to substantiate that thought also. You are probably aware that if you take time at the beginning of a meal to bow your head and in gratitude and praise thank our Heavenly Father for providing your food, for assisting us to respond nutritionally to the food and to have intelligence and a strong body and cheerfulness as a result of our eating, are you aware that our food will actually digest and be assimilated better? I wonder how it was that we first began as religious people to pray at the beginning of a meal. I suspect that holy angels or that God Himself told people that they should pray at the beginning of a meal. To do so assists digestion and increases the nutrition that we receive from our food. The same kind of thing is what we experience with the endorphins and the enkephalins. These are brain hormones, the so-called neurohormones, or they are types of neurohormones that have an influence not only at the site where they are produced, but also at a distance. It is for this reason that if a person has the production of these hormones, they are released at the site where they are made, but they go throughout the body, and as they travel throughout the body, they have a beneficial effect on the person. It is this, the presence of these hormones, these beneficial or positive neurohormones that assist the person to heal when he is ill in any way. In the book Ministry of Healing, a very fine book, and if you're not familiar with this book, I certainly urge you to purchase it and to read it. If you have it, and if you haven't read it within the last 5 years, let me urge you to read it. Ministry of Healing is the finest book ever written in human language apart from the Bible. Again, you will need to indulge me in this since it is a religious book. It is written about my favorite topic. Both of those features make it a favorite with me. Ministry of Healing has some of the finest language in it that you will find anywhere. So far as pure excellence of expression, Ministry of Healing is without a peer. The fact that it discusses all aspects of healing, whether it be from the cause of disease to the application of simple remedies, all aspects of disease and healing and wellness are discussed in the book Ministry of Healing. On page 241 in Ministry of Healing, we are given a set of positive emotions and a set of negative emotions. When we have a thought, each thought produces a different type of hormone and uses a different set of chains of nerve cells. In the production of these different hormones, we have either a good influence on the body or an evil influence on the body. Let's just discuss a few of these. Such things as fear and embarrassment, such things as anger and depression, grief, remorse, discontent, and the like. All of these are negative emotions. They produce hormones, apparently, or conditions in the body at least, that make the person less healthy than he could be if he had not produced those hormones. They are produced in the brain, but they go throughout the body. They are released into the tissue and there get into the bloodstream and are transported throughout the body, having an influence on every cell. Anger, fear, hate, discontent, remorse, grief, and so forth, all of these have a decaying influence on the body, a degenerative influence, and they invite death. On the other hand, such things as love, joy, peace, cheerfulness, contentment, and the like, these are all positive emotions. As we experience these, the neurohormones and the conditions that are set up by the stimulation of certain nerve trunks causes us to have what is mentioned in Proverbs 17:22, a rejoicing heart doeth good like a medicine. This medicine, I believe, is our neurohormones released in the brain and traveling throughout the body. Now, we have a number of centers for the control of certain systems or certain functions in the body, and I would like to tell you about the controls that we now know. There are many that have been discovered and more being discovered all the time. We have a center for the internal control of infection. We have a center for the internal control of anemia, pain, sexuality, weight, nausea, cheerfulness, appetite, and various emotions. Internal controls. These are all inside the brain, apparently. They have to do with endorphins and enkephalins, these natural opiates, or as they are called, opioids, because they are morphine-like. Like morphine. These opioids, endorphins and enkephalins, have an influence on each one of these things. Some of you may have heard of what is called the jogger's high. Just so that I can get an understanding of how many of you might have been reading about these things, would you just raise your hand if you have ever heard of the jogger's high, all right? Most of you have heard of the jogger's high. Jogger's high is given to the person or is imparted to the individual by the production of endorphins and enkephalins in the brain. This brings about then a sort of euphoria, such as one gets from taking morphine. Let's take pain and discuss how it works in the body. An interesting thing about morphine is this, that only 80% of people who are given morphine actually get a relief of pain from morphine. The other 20% will tell you that they still have pain when they go into coma from your having pushed the drug. You keep on giving more and more and more morphine. As long as they are conscious, they tell you they hurt as bad as they did. They don't care anymore because of the euphoria, that is, the sense of well-being and happiness brought about by morphine. It is this euphoria that comes from morphine that makes people get addicted to morphine. But so far as pain control is concerned, only 80% of individuals have pain relief from that. Not only that, from a 5 milligram dose of morphine, you will not have any longer time of pain control than you will from 20 milligrams of morphine, which is a whopping dose. The time is exactly the same from 5 milligrams as from 20. Well, why do you not have four times as much time in pain control from 20 milligrams as from 5 milligrams? I wonder if you can figure that out. Let me give you a clue. Morphine works to turn on the internal mechanisms of pain control. Now, can you figure it out? Why is it that a person with 5 milligrams of morphine would get the same time of pain control that he would get from 20 instead of 4 times as long? Now, I'll give you one more clue. From 5 milligrams of morphine, we would only get a certain degree of pain relief. We might get more pain relief with 10, more yet with 15, and more yet with 20. But the time is the same. Now, can you figure it out? Well, let me tell you. It is that if you give a 5 milligram dose, the body, having been jolted by the opiate, will produce a certain quantity of endorphins and enkephalins. If you give more, the body is jolted more and will produce more. So you get more endorphins and enkephalins produced, which gives you more pain relief, but not for a greater length of time, because it is the endorphins that have the time span. Morphine has nothing to do with it. It only makes its initial jolt, and then your own internal mechanisms of pain control do the rest. Now, do you see why I'm excited about endorphins and enkephalins and their discovery within this century? I think that because of the fact that we have discovered endorphins and enkephalins and can recognize that these have to do with the control of a variety of centers for maintenance of health and healing, that our understanding of this can help us to know how to apply the simple remedies. Now, I'd like to give you another illustration of how it is that endorphins and enkephalins work, and it is this. Some of you probably know that we experience a certain amount of nausea from a lot of things. We experience nausea from the chemistry in our blood. We experience a certain amount of nausea from our breath, our saliva, from the food that we eat, from the air that we breathe. And yet most of us have never actually been conscious of any nausea whatsoever from any of those things. The reason for that is that we turn on our internal mechanism of nausea control with endorphins, which we are continually producing. And as we produce those, that makes us so that we are totally oblivious to the chemistry of the blood or to the odor of the air. And many things are odorless to us for this reason. And we have no nausea. There are some poor people, unfortunately, who have chronic nausea. It isn't quite understood why they have chronic nausea, but it may have to do with the fact that they only feebly produce endorphins in the position that would assist them to turn on their anti-nausea center. Some folk at Sloan Kettering were studying this matter of endorphins and enkephalins, and were also involved in the nausea clinic at Sloan Kettering. These poor people who suffer from nausea often have every medicine in the book tried on them without success. Such was the case at the clinic for nausea at Sloan Kettering. Most of the people who had gone to the nausea clinic through the years had never received any help, and eventually the physicians would just say, well, perhaps you ought to visit the psychiatrist. And usually about that time the person would just drop out of the clinic because he would recognize that it was not a mental problem. It was something wrong with his body that was causing his chronic nausea. Well, one of the men who was working in the nausea clinic was also working in the department where they were studying endorphins and enkephalins. He got a bright idea one day. He decided that he would send out a letter to all of those people who had ever been to the nausea clinic, the letter reading as follows: Dear Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, Sloan Kettering has been approved to handle a medication which has just come to us from England. This medication is only used by Sloan Kettering. It is for nausea. If you would like to try this medication for your condition, please appear next Tuesday at 1:30 and we will issue a sample of the medication to you. At the appointed hour, about 100 people showed up. They gave him a little vial of a dark-colored medication and told them to take a small quantity of it every day and come back the following week for blood tests and other tests to make certain that their bodies were handling the medication all right. The following week, in these patients who had had everything tried on them and no success whatsoever, these patients came back. 80% of them had total relief of their medication. 80%. Now, I'm sure that most of you are thinking right away, placebo, because that's the very same spread as a placebo, 80%. It's the same as morphine also. Placebo has only 80% effectiveness, but so does morphine, only 80% effectiveness. Can anyone figure out what it was? It was not a placebo. I'll go ahead and tell you that. Can you figure out what the medication was that was given to these patients who had nausea that totally abolished their nausea? No, it wasn't charcoal. That's a good guess for anything, though. Would you understand why it was syrup of ipecac? What is syrup of ipecac given for? Yes, to make people vomit. It is given to make people vomit. Now, tell me, why were these people with chronic nausea given syrup of ipecac? Can you figure that one out? Anyone want to say? What is that? That's right. It turned on the internal mechanism of nausea control through the endorphins and enkephalins. The person had faith in it. That assisted him to turn on his mechanism. Also, the syrup of ipecac gave him a little nausea, which his body reacted against, turned on his internal mechanism of nausea control, and his nausea was abolished. 10% of the individuals had partial relief, and 10% had no relief. The very same spread as for a placebo. A number of experiments have been done along these lines that indicate to us and to many authorities who are studying this subject of endorphins and enkephalins, makes us think that probably most, if not all, healing of disease, and some of the folk at Sloan Kettering, I have heard them say this, say that probably all, certainly most, things that are given for the healing of disease work through this mechanism, through the turning on of the internal mechanisms for healing. And the folk at Sloan Kettering say whether it is counseling, whether it is medicines or surgery, whether it is shiatsu or chiropractic or osteopathy or allopathy or homeopathy or Ayurvedic or acupuncture. Whatever the method of healing or the remedy, if it works, it works through this system. Now, maybe you have heard about the sham operations. Have you heard about the placebo operations on the heart and the great benefit that have come to the patients, heart patients who went in for surgery on the heart? The primary incision was made, but for some reason, the surgery could not be accomplished. Patient was sewed back up, big bandage put on, sent back to his room. When he woke up and felt this big bandage there, he thought his operation had been done. In those individuals who have not known, from whom it was kept that they had not had their surgery, and there had been some maybe 30 or 40 such patients now that have had this kind of thing over the country, and a whopping 43% of them show a great deal of improvement. 75% of patients having a coronary bypass sham operation showed improvement. 75%. They were a lot better after the operation that didn't occur. Well, I hope you get more faith in what we can do for the body other than that is injurious to the person. Our Heavenly Father has provided for our healing by the cooperation of internal mechanisms for the healing of disease, as well as for the cooperation of natural things that He has put in nature. Would you take your book, Home Remedies? I believe you have that in front of you now. And turn to page 9. On page 9, you will see a chapter called Masterfully Engineered for Healing. And I would like to talk with you just briefly about several things having to do with our mechanisms that have been designed for us to use as healing agencies. One of the ones very easy for us to study is that of white blood cells. Our white blood cells, or leukocytes as they are sometimes referred to in our textbook here, leukocytes are masterfully engineered to protect us in infections or in any kind of inflammation. You will see three types of white blood cells. There are several others, at least three other types of white blood cells that you will see them diagrammed here on page 9. The neutrophil, the lymphocyte, and the monocyte. Each of these has a distinctive function. Some of their function overlaps a bit, some of it does not. Let us take the neutrophil. Neutrophils are foot soldiers. They are our first line of defense against disease germs. They are right on the spot when a bacterium attempts to invade your shores and puts up a barrier. A barricade is made, and it has quite powerful artillery. The average white blood cell, if it has a real liking for the germs that are invading, can eat 14 germs in half an hour. That is, if everything is in good condition. If you have been eating a lot of sugar, your white blood cells take correspondingly fewer germs. If you have had 6 teaspoons full of sugar, your white blood cells can eat only 10 germs in half an hour. 14 in half an hour if you've had no sugar. 6 teaspoons full of sugar we can eat very handily in one small Coke or in one small brownie. And if you eat 3 brownies, as many people often do at one sitting, then you would have 15 to 18 teaspoons full of sugar, which would reduce the ability of your white blood cells to eat germs all the way down to 2 in half an hour. So we can very substantially alter the way that our neutrophils can eat germs just by the way that we eat. Lymphocytes, which is the second white blood cell pictured, lymphocytes produce antibodies. We can regard antibodies as neutralizing or tying up antigens. Now let's say an antigen is a germ. Then our white blood cells, our lymphocytes, produce a chemical that simply binds it up just like this. And it fits only that germ. If the germ looks like this, then the white blood cells have to make another kind that look like this. Each one is specific for the type of antigen that is going to invade us. Lymphocytes can be injured by a lot of things that we do, such things as chilling of the body. If we have cold extremities, our lymphocytes cannot be so active in producing this chemical, nor can the chemical be so specific in attaching its various antigens. Monocytes, which is another form of white blood cell, can go in to sweep clean our field, our battlefield, after the battle has been won by the neutrophils and the lymphocytes. Then the monocytes move in like great Sherman tanks. They move slowly. They pass along with deliberation and engulf everything. They sort of like a big vacuum cleaner. They just go right along and mop up everything that's in their path. Very interesting to watch them. On pages 10 and 11, on page 10 you will see an antigen and antibody reaction and a diagram there to indicate what it looks like schematically. You will also see in the bottom of page 10 a neutrophil sending out a little pseudopod or a little veil or a foot and moving toward a germ in its environment. As it moves toward it, it simply surrounds it, and pretty soon germ is inside white blood cell. I have sat at times and watched this process, fascinated under the microscope, watching how it occurs and photographing it at various stages. It is a fascinating thing to watch. On page 11, you will see how the germ is acted on by the white blood cell. Notice these little granules in the white blood cell. Do you see those? These granules are capable of putting quite a great deal of powerful chemical into the little vesicle that the germ is in on the inside of the white blood cell. So the germ gets into the body of the white blood cell. These granules just are attracted to it. They migrate to it just as a fly crawls toward honey. Then as soon as they get up to the vesicle, they sort of melt into the vesicle containing the germ and then discharge their contents, which is a very powerful lytic substance, a very powerful dissolving substance. This is discharged inside the little capsule. If it discharged it outside in the white blood cell, it would kill itself through its own granules and through these own chemicals. So our divine designer made us with one of the most marvelous of all mechanisms. And as I have observed this occurring, You can actually see the little germ disintegrate right in front of your eyes. And to do this kind of thing is a miracle of divine designing. I appreciate this. I understand quite well the fact that such a mechanism inside of us is powerful enough to assist us with any kind of healing. On page 11, you will see at the bottom of the first column how the army is weakened. You will see that migration of white blood cells, that is their motility or movement, and also their ability to go through blood vessel linings. This is impaired by taking cortisone and cortisone-like compounds. You will see also that certain congenital abnormalities can cause a person to be weakened. Top of the second column, you can see that prenatal influences, about five lines down from the top, prenatal influences have an effect on the development of the mechanism to protect us against infections or inflammations. Notice about 15 lines down from the top of the second column, caffeine, alcohol, drugs, both licit and illicit, as well as infections that the mother suffers, can influence the ability of the offspring to fight disease. And then four lines from the bottom of that paragraph, let's just read together. An unborn baby may have the equipment for making the white blood cells permanently damaged by drugs and chemicals the mother is exposed to during her pregnancy. So we should protect very carefully the health of the mother. Now would you turn to page 13, and I would like to briefly tell you about the rate of movement of white blood cells at different temperatures. Now white blood cells move. They can move toward germs. They can move toward inflammation. They move faster if they are warmer. Let's take 23 degrees, which is a nice warm room temperature. A white blood cell can move 31.4 micron in 5 minutes. Now, you don't know how much a micron is, but you will see that it increases with one red blood cell is about 7 micron. Now, at 27 degrees, it goes up more than twice. At 33 degrees, it's 134. At 37 degrees, which is body temperature, a white blood cell can move 185 micron in 5 minutes. At 40 degrees, which is 104 degrees of oral temperature, the white blood cell can move 194.9 micron in 5 minutes. As the temperature goes up, as fever goes up and up and up, this assists us to fight disease. Fever, therefore, should not be unnecessarily brought down. Do you see how that is? It reduces our ability to fight disease. Now, on page 15, you will see that aspirin also blocks important mechanisms. Aspirin inhibits the formation of prostaglandin E in the midbrain. Now, with all of these things that we have covered, I hope that it is becoming plain to you that the body's mechanisms are quite powerful. By the stimulation that we can have by such things as air, fresh air circulating, by hot baths, by the use of electric heating pads or the application of heat by other means, by massage, by such things as friction rubs, cold mitten friction, or brush massage, by the use of herbal teas in some instances, not to be emphasizing herbal teas. They can be dangerous, but in some instances they can be useful. By the use of these various things, we can have quite a great deal of healing benefit, healing efficiency from those things that are built inside of us by a divine and all-loving Creator.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.